Welcome to episode 9 of Parallel Lines.
We're getting towards double figures. We've nearly got the hang of this.
Challenging my counting skills.
And we apologise for a slight gap and bursts and things. We've both had a few things to deal with that have been slightly more important than doing a podcast. But we're back and we promise we'll try and get into more of a rhythm of things into 2025.
We were doing so well, weren't we? We had a few on the bounce and we had a rhythm. And then, yeah, life sometimes gets in the way, doesn't it?
And a year ago, we started lining up people that I've realised we've gone through the whole year and we haven't spoken. You know, last January, I messaged several people who we said, would you like to come on our podcast? And they said, oh, we'd love to. And we haven't been back to them. So
I'm very conscious of that. And also we had some feedback in our wonderful Contact Us inbox around doing things this autumn. We are now sat here in autumn and we haven't. So apologies. Those things are not forgotten. They're just filed.
Yes. And we will be back with all those people. So first of all, we need to mention our last podcast, which was with Ollie. And you want to congratulate him?
I do, yes. Our lovely friend Ollie Glover MP is now officially a member of the Transport Select Committee, which is excellent news. And I think he's going to be fab at that. I really do.
It's going to be interesting to have someone on the Transport Select Committee who knows all about transport. That will be a shock because they might find that people in front of them talking to them get asked very direct questions.
Yeah.
So you better do your homework. If you get asked to go and talk to the Transport Select Committee, don't think you're going to get away with any waffle.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you should expect some detailed questions, some expert questions. And actually, Ollie's not the only one. Looking at the lineup, there's some pretty good people on there across the board, actually, from all transport modes. Yep. So I think that's going to be a really interesting committee. It always is, of course, for us. But I think it's going to be really interesting to watch.
And it's been an interesting time since the election for transport generally, because there's things like the bus fare change. You know, a lot of people
didn't see
that
one coming, Tony, did you?
Yeah. There was a feeling that it was actually going to be announced £2.50 and then £3 incrementally and gradually fade away. So they've not said it's going to fade away. Will they dare? That's going to be an interesting one. So some, you know, general transport stuff, intriguing.
That bus thing, I didn't see coming. And I know this is a railway podcast, but, you know, I love transport of all kinds, public transport in particular. And I love that £2 bus fare because it's simple and it works for people like me who are not bus experts. I'm really not. I live in a city that I didn't grow up in. And so I don't always know where I'm going and, you know, which buses go where. So I don't know if this was an intended consequence of the flat fare, but it's that coupled with the not needing change anymore because you can actually pay with contactless technology has been a real enabler for me to use buses more because I feel confident now getting on a bus, not having to say where it is I want to go to, just, you know, I want a single, I know it's going to be £2, blip, away I go. And then, you know, you watch out the window and you don't feel like a wally when you get the wrong stop. You just get off and walk a bit further. Yeah. It's made for people like me.
Well, absolutely. And as you get to the stage like I have, where you regularly have to nip to hospital to check that you're still functioning, you know, I've now found a bus that goes to the hospital. I know where it stops at the hospital. £2. Why would I be going in and paying £5 to park plus all the hassle when it's there? So that was a great thing. So can we accept that the £3 thing is going
to,
you know...
Do you know, I think it depends who you speak to, because to me, £3 still seems really good value for a lot of the things that I use the bus for. But if you're using the bus to maybe get to a job that pays minimum wage or, you know, you're in a different situation to that I am financially, you know, it's an increase of a significant proportion, isn't it, going from £2 to £3. So it will make a big difference to some people. Anyway, back to trains.
Yes, act fast and fix things. What do you reckon?
Well, we did trail this, didn't we, a few episodes ago on one of our musings, which this is another musings episode.
Yeah, but sadly, we haven't got a guest. If you're waiting for us to announce the guest, then...
Not happening, we're just musing. And we did say, didn't we, that was what's been said, act fast and fix things. And I think we're beyond the 100 days now. The first 100 days are always exciting, aren't they, in a new management team, a new government in this case. And actually, if we're honest, have we seen much yet? We didn't expect to, did we? We said it won't happen quickly. It's the railway. But if anybody was expecting it to happen quick, they're surely disappointed now, aren't they, Tony?
Well, there's a lot of clues, aren't there? If you voted Labour because you wanted a railway that ran on time and that would be cheap to use, you've not got either yet. And the clue in the fare increase already announced for next year is clearly you're not going to get your fare slashed. If people thought that was one of the big things that was being promised, that's not happening.
Yeah, and I think, you know, so two things there. Performance, well, I think the report card would continue to say variable and, in general, not good enough. So, you know, yes, there are still some leading lights somewhere in the country that are delivering great performance. One or two of them, some of whom have been pointing this out quite publicly that they're doing okay, and we won't name names. Elsewhere in the country, it's bloody hard work delivering a decent level of performance, but really patchy. So, you know, today I travelled on a couple of different operators in the north of England. Some of my trains were bob on time leaving, you know, kept really well to time, were the train that they were supposed to be and all that good stuff. You think, yeah, we're having a great day on the railway. But then, oh, hey, York Station was an absolute shambles today with all sorts of problems, you know, of different types, causing very long delays, cancellations across several operators, some of whom have been nationally operated for quite some time. And so I think the evidence, you know, if we look at the dashboard of kind of performance here, what are the various gauges showing us? It's still not great, and it doesn't have a lot to do with who's at the top of the pay slip of the people who are operating these things at the minute, you know?
And that's the other thing. And interestingly, we were, before your plans fell apart, we were going to meet in Manchester and record the hello bit on a train from Manchester to Liverpool. Now, not only were you unable to get the train you planned to be on, but also, had I tried to come into Manchester to meet you, my train was cancelled as well, going into Manchester, shortage of train crew. So doubly our plans were thwarted there. And that is what people are encountering at the moment. And that is the thing. One bad experience, you tell your family and friends about it, and that bad thing ripples again, doesn't it?
It is. And linking this to the new government and their stated intentions, you know, about everything's about growth, everything's about getting the economy back on track. You know, that was a mild inconvenience for us, Tony. We're both, you know, self-employed and kind of flexible in life, you know, kind of flexibly employed. And, you know, we can change our plans quite easily. It's not the case for other people in different situations who are, you know, trying to get to important meetings that can't be moved. And we always hear about the terribly sad stories as well, don't we, about people getting to, I don't know, hospital appointments, funerals, that kind of thing. All of that goes on. And in a space where you're trying to use public transport as a means of at least supporting, if not delivering, some of this economic growth, it isn't half hard, isn't it, when it's not working properly?
Yeah, and this is the other thing that we were pointing out several podcasts ago, and people we've spoken to have agreed with us, or we've agreed with them. As you said, the name on the top of the door as you walk in is almost irrelevant at the moment, because there are some fundamental things that need fixing, and the ownership of the business is pretty irrelevant. It needs some clever people to come up with some good ideas to get everything running smoothly. And those generally will be the same people, whoever is putting the money into their pockets.
Yep.
The only thing we were just chatting before we started recording was the one thing the government has got to be careful of is that it doesn't act fast and fix things so fast and fix things that A, it breaks things, but also that it annoys the people who do know what to do and who are the clever brains, many of whom could retire. Many of them have got pension pots that are full now. Yeah. So they could say, if you're just going to interfere, like perhaps previous governments have interfered and looked over their shoulder and said, oh, we don't like you doing that, they'll just say, I've finished now, I'm off.
I think it's a real danger, Tony, because as well, when we talk to people, which you and I do around the industry, particularly at that, let's say, senior end, both in tenure and in perhaps years, so senior in both meanings of the word, they've already had, you know, a good few years of what you might call interference, you know, with everything that came about really in the post May 18 era of performance dropping, pandemic, change of contracts, you know, more and more government intervention and they might say meddling. That's the backdrop. And if you've already had that for years and you're approaching an age and a pension pot size that means you just don't need this. You know, it doesn't take much, I would suggest, to nudge some people one way or the other. You can either keep them way beyond their retirement age, and we see that across the industry. I'm fortunate enough to work with some wonderful septuagenarians and you know, they still have a lot left in the tank. But at that age, with a full railway pension or generous private pension, you've got to want to stay. You're not staying because you have to. You've got to be invested in the mission, haven't you? Yeah. And so I think that mission critical thing of rebuilding a railway that we can be proud of is what the government needs to be careful to nurture and recognise that actually those people exist across the industry. And, you know, they might not like it. The government might not like it, or certain people in government might not like it. But some of that talent exists well buried within the private operators that they might philosophically and politically dislike.
Yes.
You know, the people are what's important, not the companies themselves. It's the talent and the knowledge that exists within those organisations that we need.
And of those people, some of them are looking forward to the new era and are quite happy to be moving out of being owned or being employed by private companies back to being part of the state railway. But they're looking forward to it at the moment until they get upset or until they're reassured, and then they'll make their decision to go one way or the other.
Yeah.
So the act fast and fix things thing, which is hard to say, they have got to remember those lessons. And we can refer to projects, things like the Great Western Electrification, and when it went all pear-shaped and massively over budget and everything, and then they said, oh, why is it going wrong? They said, because nobody involved at the moment has ever done anything like this before, because we cleared them all out. And then they started phoning up all the people who'd done it in the past, who were sitting in their easy chairs at home, retired. And they said, could you just tell us how you did this thing, you know, and what were the lessons we should have learnt? And this could happen nationally if people aren't encouraged to remain as part of the industry and to use their expertise. That's the big worry, I think.
And I think the expertise needs to be applied to shape in the future. And I wrote about this recently, that those people you just described who are looking forward to it at the moment, they're looking forward to being part of the design. I think what will scare them off is if they are dictated to.
Yeah.
If they're told, this is the blueprint, we've already decided it, and we just want you to deliver it. I think that's a really good way of switching them off, because actually they'll feel like they're not part of the solution. They're not invested in the solution. How can you feel passionately about it if you haven't been part of designing it? And I think that's the risk. And we're seeing a bit of that, aren't we, at the moment in sort of the world of, I don't know, LinkedIn and other places where people are maybe starting to say, hang on a minute, don't be too hasty, you know, and these kind of messages coming across. And there's a bit of that going on. And then in other parts of the forest, there's people clearly keeping their head down at the minute going, let's just see how this goes. Let's just play nice. Let's not fall out with anyone. And I'm always really intrigued to see which behaviour is going to go where in the journey. You know?
Early on in the era of privatisation, there were people who said, if the government ever starts telling us what time the trains will run, then we're out. And there was quite a leading railway person who took their retirement because the government had phoned them and said, the 8:15 from X, we want to run at 8:17.
Oh, really?
And they said, that's it. You know, we don't need that kind of interference. And so the people behind the way the railway's going to be need to leave it to the experts to do. And that includes things like, because we've just been chatting about it in the car. In the last sort of 20 years, we've had previous governments deciding what trains people want, buying them, ordering them, procuring them, and riddling them not only with strange clauses in the contracts that are costing tens, hundreds of millions of pounds of taxpayers' money, but they're the wrong level of comfort, or they don't have things on board. I know we talked about it with Ollie in the last one about whether there should be catering on board or not, but it's been government decisions. Government have ordered them. Civil servants have been ordering trains, really, without necessarily thinking about what's really needed. And so we've seen what happens when the state takes control, and it's got to learn to let go and just say, we're going to hand the thing over to the experts to run. Obviously, this is your budget. Obviously, this is what we'd like you to deliver in terms of a railway. But we're not going to phone you every Monday morning and say, have you done that thing?
Yeah.
And they're still doing it at the moment. You know, we can talk about it because the companies have talked about it fairly openly. Chiltern's got to find some trains to replace its 50-year-old trains. And it's been told, evaluate three different fleets that might be on the market. So it starts doing tons of paperwork to evaluate the three. Then it finds one's not going to be available in time. And the other one, they've given to another company. They've given to Great Western without any go through any evaluation. They basically phoned them up and said, you're having this lot. So they've got one option left. But they've spent months and hundreds of man hours or person hours doing all the maths, doing the business plan. And behind their back, other deals are being done.
Because it's still not coordinated.
It's not coordinated. And it's not the same thing happening everywhere. It's random.
So a couple of things there then. One is, I wonder what the, I hate this phrase, but I'm going to use it, I wonder what the red lines are of this generation. You know, so you mentioned the people saying, if they tell me what time the trains run, are we off? I wonder what the red lines are in this generation, what will send people over the edge, you know, into leaving. That'll be really interesting to watch. And then on your point about leaving it to the experts, I think that links right back to what we were saying about performance levels at the moment. in that, to be fair, and it's not often that I might be this fair to, you know, government and civil servants per se, to be fair to them, it's hard to give over that trust completely when you're giving it to the people who don't appear to be doing a brilliant job at the moment, they might perceive. You know, so if the headline performance levels are as bad for as long as they have been, asking them to say, oh, well, don't worry, we're the experts, you know, leave us to it, we know what we're doing. They might say, do you? Because, you know, it ain't going so well, guys, is it? So, you know, that's difficult, isn't it, to expect that level of trust? I suppose it all comes back to trust, doesn't it? Do the passengers trust us? Do the people, you know, clienting this stuff and you know, funding it trust us, which is ultimately the passenger with government acting on their behalf? Well, how can they trust us if we can't deliver the base product, you know, getting trains, the right trains to the right place at the right time? You know, if we can't deliver that, then how can we expect them to trust us? So we've got to improve. We've got to raise the waterline on performance, haven't we? That's it, isn't it?
And I was thinking about this the other day. I had a long journey and at nearly every station, I had to change trains several times. And at every one, the train came in on time, but it was just a little bit late leaving because there wasn't anything from the platform staff. And you look, I look out the door and I'm thinking, well, if we haven't moved yet, maybe they're helping someone on. Oh, no, no. Every door is clear. What's happening?
I see this so often at the minute.
Yeah.
We had this on our little, you know, we had a little weekend away recently for our wedding anniversary. And we used the train completely off peak, going out for an evening meal, travelling with the doggy. It's good to travel with your dog if you have a dog. Trains are great for them. And I had the same thing at every station. I was looking, expecting to see an issue. You know, is there a ramp for somebody? Is there a buggy? Is there a wheelchair? Is there an elderly person taking their time to get on and off? Is there a lot of passengers? So we need to have a bit of time to let them on and off. None of these things. It was just, I'm just not on it. The wheels just didn't turn at 00. People were just not punchy, you know, just not enthusiastic about getting that train off on time. And I just wonder if that's malaise that's kind of set in from years of feeling a bit down about the railway, just feeling a bit down about working on the railway. Delayed pay deals, industrial relations problems, pandemic, you know, all of that. How do people feel about just running a railway enthusiastically nowadays? It's hard, isn't it, to motivate people when they've been through all that, I think.
Yeah, I think that is what I've noticed. There isn't that sort of passion for getting a train away on time anymore. Years ago, when I first started writing about railways seriously, so we're going back maybe 20 years or so, early privatisation, there was a guy at Leicester Station who was about a million years old and he refused to retire. Eddie, I'm sure he was called Eddie. Somebody messaged us if he wasn't called Eddie. And he got an award at one of the awards events because of his enthusiasm and his longevity and his decision to keep working. He could dispatch a train. I saw a train come in and him turn it around in 19 seconds. I timed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Safely, and I hope.
Safely, all the doors, and it was swingy doors as well. Oh, but basically, the moment it was clear nobody else was getting on or off, he blew the whistle, and he had a whistle and everything, and he turned a nearly late arrival into an on-time departure. But he had this, that was his thing, and he was getting, we had a standing ovation at an awards event for him because of his enthusiasm. And I don't see that kind of thing now. And in fact, I was at a station a couple of years ago, and I said, do you not blow a whistle just to get people? Oh, we're not allowed to blow whistles anymore. We've had the whistles taken off as health and safety. We're not supposed to make people rush because there's a danger in that. So they haven't even got those fake electronic, because some of them have got these fake electronic whistles now. They press a button and it makes a whistle sound, which I think is awful anyway. If you can have a whistle.
Oh, I haven't heard those.
Have you not seen them? Oh, they're
not
electric.
Knowingly, anyway.
They make electric sound and it sounds like a whistle, but they're pressing a little button. So we need to get back to the Acme Thunderers, proudly held in the hand, and the whistle to get people on the train and shuffling along a bit to get on and get things moving. And there isn't any of that, but it might be because, there isn't the passion to do it. There isn't the enthusiasm. I remember watches that would synchronise to the national time signal, and one of the companies gave all their members of staff Wagon. That's going back a bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wagon gave every member of staff the radio-controlled watch so that they knew that they were all... They couldn't even say, oh, well, I looked at my watch and my watch said it was
there
on
was
time.
A trend of that in the Right Time Railway days where those radio watches got given away. And I also remember, I think it was Stuart Firth, who I'll name drop. We'll find out if Stuart listens to the podcast because he might well message in and go, it wasn't me, Anna Jane, it was somebody else. But in the Right Time Railway days, this would have been down somewhere like Thames Valley, I think. I remember, I'm sure it was Stuart saying, I think it was Didcot Parkway, it should sound like a rave in the morning peak. I want to hear so many whistles that it sounds like a rave. And I always remember that being really like, I was in my 20s. I thought it was cool that he said that. But there's something in that, isn't there, of kind of invoking a bit of like passion in the process. Yes. You know, you should really be getting into this, like, obviously not whistling for no reason. But I got what he meant. He meant, you know, we should really have a noise going on here. Yeah. This should be a purpose to this noise. And we should be trying to get people down the platform, spaced out, where the doors are, get them on the train, get the thing off on time. And I think you're right, Tony. I see very little of that at the minute. And I find myself harking back to my right time railway days quite a lot at the minute and saying, like, get them off on time. They've got more chance of coming back in on time. Things that I remember people saying right at the start of my career, and they're no less true now. Yeah. It's just, it seems like we need reminding of them. And I can't help but think that it is people are just a bit down, a bit weary, a bit, you know, I don't know how to get the passion back.
Yeah.
Answers on a postcard.
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you're one of those, I'm glad we got rid of whistles people, then send your reasons on one side of an A4 paper.
Let's have the debate. Email us. Yeah. Let us know.
Send us a voice note, anything. This is why I got rid of whistles on my railway. But definitely, and the thing was, because it's gone, somebody popping up and saying, I think we should do this now, you've got to start all over again with the relearning, whereas people did join the industry 20, 30 years ago, and they saw everybody doing the right time dispatch stuff, and they did it because everybody else was doing it. I remember doing some work for a train company years ago. They were doing a staff training thing on running the right time railway. And you were probably somewhere else doing the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it was things like telling them, if you see someone at the top of the ramp and it's time to go, you can't sit there and wait for them saying it's okay, guys. Because if you did that and cost 30 seconds at every one of the stations into London, you are so late by the time you get to London that you've ruined the timetable for thousands of people.
Thousands of people because, for that one person at the top of the ramp.
Yeah. So, and this is back to passengers as well. Listen to this. If you say, well, look, they saw me coming. I was only half a mile away and I was waving, wait. And they closed the doors and they went. That is because those 30 seconds of waiting could be vital, but people understood that. But it's understanding your part in the whole process of
the system.
Getting the railway. Yes,
and we talk about this a lot. It's system thinking, and we need more system thinking. But that means you have to accept your role in the system, and that it is just one part. You know, nobody exists on their own. No line, no operator, no passenger. You know, has precedence. It's all part of a system. And that worries me in regards to things like our ability to deliver for people who require additional assistance on the railway. And this is a really emotive subject. I understand, of course it is. You know, we've got an ageing population. We've got a lot of people who rightly want to access the railway, you know, in wheelchairs or with other mobility assistance requirements. But how do you provide a great experience for those people and run a punctual railway for the many other hundreds and thousands of people who don't have those additional needs? It's a real big challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's huge. And I do wonder sometimes whether we're setting ourselves up to fail with that, because I don't know how you get that right. You know, one passenger needing a ramp for whatever reason isn't more important, are they, than the other 500 people on the train? And I don't think they'd want to think that they are. But how do you ever accommodate that in a timetable that's got to run the same every time, regardless of whether that ramp is needed or not?
Yeah, the theory might be that you assume that every service will have one longer stop somewhere. So that by the time it maybe. Mm-hmm. But that's very interesting, because actually coming over here, we sat outside Liverpool South Parkway for ages waiting to come in off the CLC line, because there's a train sat in the platform. And as I was walking through the parkway to change trains to come here, I heard a couple of staff say, fancy having to do two wheelchairs on the same train. So the train had been stuck in a platform, but the signallers didn't know. And we could have gone into the station because they were waiting for it to leave to cross the tracks we were on. If the signallers knew and if the system was all set up perfectly, the signallers would have known there's two wheelchairs to unload at Parkway. So we can hold that train legitimately, let the train in that's coming in that Tony's on. Not because I'm on it. There was a train once called Tony's train at First Northwestern because I moaned about it so much, but that's going back a bit. It's because it never stopped at my station. I moaned about it so much. They called it Tony's train because I could never get it. But actually, had the system really been joined up and they'd known that at Liverpool South Parkway, the train to Birmingham was going to have to sit there for quite a while they did move the ramp to two doors, as it happened, which was a really long hold.
So that's about systems thinking again, isn't it? And communication, which we're not always the best at. Because
somebody
would have known about that.
Yeah.
But did the right people know about it? And did they tell somebody else in the chain that they needed to know. Interesting example.
And I was just going to say on the dispatch thing as well, if you are trained so brilliantly at Manchester Piccadilly platforms 13 and 14 that you can shout, get behind the red line with the kind of Gestapo-like precision that they do.
How did I know you were going to mention the red line?
But why can't they be just as good at getting the trains away on time as they are at shouting at people who dare to step? I had about a millimetre of my foot over the other
day. Your big toe.
Yeah, it wasn't even my whole big toe, my little toe. And they're barking away at me. And I was thinking, just use that energy to get the trains away.
Apply
as well.
The energy to the right part of the process. That flipping red line, it still annoys you, doesn't it?
You said he was going to cross the red lines
earlier. Oh, there you go,
This is it. They've actually painted them at Oxford Road. So moving on a little bit, but it's come up again today in the news about the government's ordered an inquiry into how train companies deal with passengers who've got the wrong tickets or who haven't paid. And so we have the two different things at the same time. Some people haven't paid because they
didn't want to pay, presumably.
And as one of the very first articles I wrote for Modern Railways many, many years ago, when I stood with the managing director of one of the companies on the morning gate line as they did the ticket checks, and he said, some people don't want to pay us because they don't think it's worth the money. And that was
Performance doesn't help with, because when performance is poor, there are, I'm going to do pop psychology here, Tony, and say, when performance on the railway is poor, I bet you there are more people inclined to think, why should I pay for it? It's rubbish.
Indeed.
Or other more colourful ways of putting that, perhaps.
Yeah.
I would say that's probably a numerical, what do you call it, when there's like a relationship mathematically between, you know...
There's a mathematical relationship.
Between poor performance and, you know, propensity to pay for what is deemed to be a crap service.
So we've got some people who don't think it's worth paying. Some people don't want to pay because they just don't want to pay.
Mm.
But we've also got an awful lot of people who we've seen have got the wrong ticket. They're with the wrong company. It's the wrong time of day. There's been the big thing in the press because Northern prosecuted a lad who paid £1.60 and it allowed him to buy a rail card fare when he shouldn't have and all that kind of stuff. And I was thinking about this and I was thinking, the thing is, this goes back again to government control and what they wanted. And this might be useful for listeners to hear again. When I was young, off-peak was after 9.30. Peak time was before 9.30. Weekends were all off-peak. And there were a few little exceptions, like if you lived out in the sticks and there was only one train that ran at 9 o'clock in the morning and there wasn't another one for a fortnight, then they'd call that off-peak because it was so lightly used or whatever. But basically, everybody knew 9.30 is the thing. And then creeping in over the early years of privatisation, when the government started to say, we need to get some money out of the industry, they let the companies individually change the rules differently. So I was pondering this earlier. It was someone like Southwestern, their off-peak started sometime after dinner. Sorry, lunch. Oh, in the north, aren't I? Is it dinner or lunch?
Dinner.
After dinner time. And then you had super off-peaks and semi-off-peaks. And then the companies going to London changed it from, instead of the time you got on the train, it was what time the train arrived in London. So the rules were different then at every station. And they had to put big posters up saying, this train you can't get on because it's peak and this one you can. And it got more and more complex. And a lot of it was down to government saying, will this make more money for us, or reduce the subsidy, or increase payments back to us in premiums and things. The governments could have just said, no, it's just the rule. When we privatised it, when you let the contract, it said off-peak's 9.30, that's it, off-peak's 9.30. Suck it up, guys. And they didn't. And each time the company said, can we move it a bit more? Can we make it 10.30? Can we make it 11? Can we have it when it's arrived in London? It was generally always, yeah, right.
So I feel a myth-busting moment is necessary here. And funnily enough, I was actually having this debate with my dad over a glass of wine the other week. He of such long railway employ that he has never bought a ticket in his whole entire life, I would just point out, but yet has strong views about this.
Because he has a pass, not just because he just winked.
I should point out because he's always enjoyed
not
the
jumping
privilege.
Over a lot of fences.
Yeah, he's always enjoyed the privilege of free travel, and he continues to because he's so old that he's retained his retired travel privileges in his dotage. But anyway, he has friends who have to buy tickets and he travels with friends, and he was asking me, why is it so fiendishly complicated, blah, blah, blah. And the myth-busting, which you sort of alluded to there, was we should remember there were ticket restrictions pre-privatisation. It's not to be forgotten that a lot of it was baked in. It existed before. You always had off-peak. You always had things like differences between, I don't know, intercity and regional operators. There were always you know, there was a great big ticketing handbook that existed before privatisation. They didn't create it in, you know, the 1990s when they created all these private operators. So whilst you're right to say it may have become more complex since privatisation, the myth is that it was created by privatisation. It absolutely wasn't. Where I think we could do a lot more is in regards to technology and making it clearer for people. Because actually, you wouldn't expect to turn up for an EasyJet flight with a Ryanair ticket. You just wouldn't.
Yeah.
But equally, you wouldn't be able to, because you wouldn't make it any further than the security gate or whatever. Somebody would point out to you that you were trying to access the wrong plane. We don't really have enough of those, I think, system checks built in. So people end up on the wrong train because it's possible to end up on the wrong train. And the example you gave of the lad who was prosecuted, he bought the wrong ticket because he was able to buy the wrong ticket. The system shouldn't have allowed him to buy the wrong ticket.
Yeah.
If you can't use a rail card on that ticket, then it shouldn't have allowed him to. It did. So the system let us down, I think, and put a passenger in a situation that that passenger shouldn't have been put in. Now, intentions aside, because, you know, what are people trying to do? Are they trying to play the system? Of course, there will be people who are trying to, but the system should have safeguards in place to stop that happening, shouldn't it? In this day and age, you just shouldn't be able to.
So do you think maybe in the great unpicking of things that the government says in its Fix Things, maybe we need to standardise the rules a little bit more for things like when is a peak? Okay, there was never an evening peak.
Mm.
You know, when I was young, if you bought an off-peak ticket, you could come home on any train. Now it's, but you can't come home over the evening peak, which didn't used to exist. And they're throwing little things in like that. And by the way, when I got my first student rail card, the same rule applied then about a minimum fare.
Mm.
But actually, the minimum fare now proportionally is a lot lower than it was, because it was £10, when I think, when I was a student. And it's only 12 now.
And so why has that,
you know,
happened?
I was a student so long ago, they hadn't invented computers when I was a student. Well,
you're aging yourself nearly. Now, Tony.
All right. When I was a student and I had my student rail card, there were rules that applied, apart from in August. It was that thing in July and August when you're on
when
summer
you're
holidays,
to be
you
not
could do it.
Studying. Yeah. Yeah.
You could use it for anything. But so it's not like it wasn't a rule that they, British Rail invented the rule.
Yeah.
So it's not like another evil privatised railway thing. We do need to remember that. It's just that the privatised railway has made a lot of rules that were very simple, more complicated, like your cheap ticket starts at 9:30. Which everybody knew.
So to answer the question, do I think they need to simplify it? I think to answer that question, you need to look at what is the point of the rule, really? And maybe that's gotten lost in some of this. What's the point of the rule? But isn't the point of, say, the off-peak return issue that you mentioned? If we've got enough space on the trains to allow people to travel unrestricted on an off-peak return portion, then of course, make it simple, allow them to. But my understanding is a relative non-expert, you know, this is not my area of great expertise, fares and ticketing. I know a bit about it, but not a lot. My understanding was that it was in large part to do with controlling demand and controlling capacity on trains. So if we have restricted capacity, which we do in lots of places, then one way of controlling that, you know, controlling overcrowding, giving a better experience for passengers all round, is to say, well, you can't travel with that ticket because we need to restrict access to that service. So I think you need to ask about what is the point in the rule. And this is where I think people get a little bit emotional about it and the debate kind of wanders off a bit, because everybody thinks that ticketing is all about giving passengers lower prices. And it isn't, is it? That's part of the equation. But it's in tension directly opposite to other things like paying for the damn railway or, you know, having enough seats for people. What you wouldn't want is to have, oh yeah, we've got all these cheap tickets for everybody. It's great, but we've got no space on the train. So it's an absolutely awful experience for people. You know, you've got to put these things against each other and say, well, maybe it's a balance, I think.
Yeah.
And okay, the balance might have gone a little bit wrong in some of those areas you mentioned, but I don't think it's as easy as to say, oh, let's just make it really simple. They're having a go at that, aren't they? The LNER trial with single leg pricing at the minute. It hasn't been met with unanimous applause, has it? People have different views on it because it's not that simple.
Yes. It's still got terms and conditions.
Yeah.
And I may actually ask advertising standards whether the terms and conditions ought to be clearer, because I think they're too hidden. But we understand it's all about yield management to a certain extent, particularly on long
distance. That was the phrase I couldn't think of. Yield management.
There we go. It's yield management. And certainly for long distance, that's the thing that we sort of understand still. Mm-hmm. It's balancing the two things. We have the pride that you can buy a ticket that will get you on the first train that comes, because you can't do that in every country.
Yep.
And we're very proud of that thing. We also don't want to make it so incredibly expensive that you would have to sell your house to get on the first train that comes. And one of the things about the LNER trial is they say, well, you can do things and change your ticket as long as there's a seat. Well, I might be prepared to stand because I'm in a hurry.
Yep.
Or something has changed. But I can't actually change my ticket if I'm prepared to stand. They're starting to set rules. Now, there's another bunch of people who say, well, if they can't provide you a seat, then you shouldn't have to pay anyway.
And this is what I mean. You can't please everybody, can you? Because for every person who says, but I'd be prepared to stand if I could pay less, because, you know, I'm an ultimate bargain seeker, kind of, you know, that's how I view the service. The service is about getting me from A to B, but I don't mind what level of comfort I travel in. For every one person who feels like that, you've got somebody else who thinks it's an outrage if they don't have a really comfortable seat, you know, with access to a hot cup of coffee and Wi-Fi that's fast enough to watch Netflix. You know, that it becomes a very difficult task trying to please everybody. So my question, I suppose, is just where in that do we compromise? How do we make the right compromises, given it's taxpayers' money, given, you know, that there is so much information out there at your fingertips? If we made the rules more easily accessible, visible and understandable, would that be enough? You know, because I mentioned the airlines quite a lot in this. People don't love the restrictions that some of the budget airlines, for instance, impose on them, but they kind of live with them, don't they, for their once a year holiday to the Costas, and they kind of get over it that you have to pay extra for baggage and you have to pay extra to print your boarding pass and, you know, all the rest of it. Because they can see it, they can understand it, it's a bit more transparent. What people don't like, and I believe some of the airlines have actually been taken to task on this, is when it's hidden.
Yes.
People don't like it when it's a surprise that you've got to pay 15 quid for your boarding pass. And I get that. I think people, consumers generally, will live with most rules, however daft they might seem to some people, if they understand them, if they're transparent and consistent and consistently applied by the staff enforcing them.
There might be a difference between people who fly twice a year and people who go by train three times a week as well.
Correct, but in the new world, there's fewer people doing that, apparently, because people aren't commuting every day. So what does that do to our understanding of these are all relevant factors, aren't they? That used to be super relevant when people were in the habit of travelling twice a day, 5 days a week, absolutely every week, except for their trip to the Costas for 2 weeks in August. But apparently that's not the world we live in now.
But that's interesting, because I was talking to the MD of one of the train companies where commuters keep jumping onto their trains and crowding out the people who have on a long distance leisure trip, and it might be their only journey a year, and they find that actually they've got people all over them for a 15-minute commute. Is there any way that we could segregate those two flows? And that is the big challenge, isn't it? They have said to a large group of people, is there any way that we could do something to say, commuters, that's not your train. Your train is 1 minute behind and it's full of commuting space. These people are going on a long journey. Leave them alone.
Well, again, I think that has been tried over the years. There's again, always try and sort of put my hands up here and say not an expert in this, but my understanding is that has been done with things like pricing. So, you know, the Stag and Hen Do trains between Liverpool and Newcastle are a really good example, you know, where the pricing is managed in such a way that it's clear which train is, you know, for you. You know. You're looking at your 3 o'clock where you've got your tins open on your way kind of thing, not 5 o'clock when everybody's coming out of the office. Also, pricing differentials between express and stopping trains, you know, that's one of the ways that plays out. You know, so if you've got all day to get there to visit your grandchildren, you might not mind a train to London that calls more than, say, if you're a business traveller who really needs to get there super quick for a 10 o'clock or a 9 o'clock meeting. That's the train that you need to be on. So I think there are ways of doing that and that have been tried. My observation would be that there'll always be exceptions and there'll always be, reservations are another way of doing it. You can have a coach that is entirely for reservations, i.e. your grannies and your leisure travellers. And then another carriage that's unreserved, which you're trying to aim at the commuters. But what you can't police for is the commuter that gets on and sits in the first seat that they come to, which might be a reserved one. You can try these things, but people are people, aren't they?
I've heard it called the Coventry conundrum, but I'll call it the Wolverhampton conundrum because it's exactly the same.
Yeah, yeah.
So Wolverhampton's one of those places where commuters to Birmingham will jump on the first train that comes. And most of their season tickets or whatever are valid on any of the trains, or most of their tickets are. So they always jump on the one that's not going to stop at Dudleyport, Tipton, Coesley. Can't remember them all anymore. Smethwick. So they don't want that one because it's going to take a long time. So they jump on the express that's going to go straight to Birmingham, and they crowd it all out with people who are actually on the way to Southampton Airport or whatever.
Yeah.
But you can't actually restrict it in some way. You can't get on the train at Wolverhampton because some people are getting on at Wolverhampton that are going to Southampton Airport.
Yeah.
So unless you've got somebody standing at the door saying, you're not on the list, you're not coming in on
how
every
do
door.
You please? Well, and that's it. And because you do have pick up and set down only trains, don't you, as well? And I always think that doesn't really work because you don't have somebody on every door going, oh, you can't actually get on and off. Nobody's going to wrestle them to the ground, are they? I mean, let's be honest, they're not, are they? So these are trade-offs, and careful what you wish for, because you mentioned before, we are very proud of turn up and go ticketing in this country. It's not the case in other countries. I don't think people would want to get rid of that. I don't think there's an appetite in this country to say, you know, that all long distance trains are reservation only, for instance. You could do that. Yeah. And in some ways it would make it easier for, I think probably from an operational perspective for the people running it, arguably it'd be easier. But I don't think it's what passengers want. I don't think it's what users of the system actually would want from it. So careful what you wish for. Definitely about trade-offs. And remember, it's not all about the cheapest ticket. I don't think it is always about the cheapest ticket. And I find myself saying this a lot. I actually think what passengers and users of the railway want is good value, not cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
People don't mind paying if it's good. And again, I'm going to sound like a broken record on this podcast today. It comes back to performance, doesn't it? When performance is shit, people think it's expensive. They think it's bad value for money. That's what they mean. They say expensive. What they mean is I'm paying a load of money for something that's rubbish. And actually, if you make the thing better, people pay thousands of pounds to travel on airlines that are really, really good, award-winning airlines. It's expensive. But they think it's good value for money because they get a great service from it and they come away feeling great. We're not delivering journeys often enough that people come away from feeling great about it. And so they complain about the price.
Yeah. Gosh, so I think we're starting to see how the act fast and fix things line is just so difficult because of the complexity. You can't just simplify fares. You can't just suddenly make the fares cheaper. You can't make the trains run on time instantly. It's got to have buy-in from everybody involved, including the people who use the trains to see things differently. And to see that somebody's got to pay for all this, whether you pay through your taxes or the fare box, you know, all that argument about who pays for it, but it's got to be there. The people doing it have got to get the pride back in making things happen on time.
Mm.
And it will probably be fascinating. I mean, they have to do this because it occurred to me the other day that there are always people complaining that the train's late. Every comedy panel show, somebody will get a gag in about, of course, the train's late. They ought to actually do a day where they follow a couple of trains on the telly or something and highlight what it is, all the tiny little things that make it late. And is it sometimes because passengers are messing around?
Yeah.
Sometimes it is. It's sometimes,
yeah, it happens.
As I think I recounted on one of our very early podcasts, you know, watching a couple wandering up and down on the platform of a train at Reading, trying to spot their reserved seat on the inside, and all the staff saying, please just get on and find your seat because it's waiting. And the staff saying to me, this late train at Reading is going to affect trains at Bristol and Birmingham. And because two people had decided to peer through the window and look for their seat number. So sometimes it is part of the people, the user's job to play the game better.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the people who are operating in them, whether they're on platforms or in signal boxes or driving or planning timetables or whatever, that all need to play this game together. It would be really fascinating to explain to people that train did set off on time, but look at the things that made it late. It was a couple of passengers who did something, okay? But then it was a piece of infrastructure that broke because it's been needing to be replaced for 10 years. But somebody said, can we save money by not doing it for another three?
Do we know any commissioners at like the BBC or something? It sounds like I've got a concept here for a programme, a day in the life of a train. We could follow a train, you know, from, you'd have to do it like from Penzance to Aberdeen or something really long distance to get everything in, wouldn't you? Because I bet on that train's journey in a day, it will experience most of those things, you know, some passenger issues, some infrastructure issues, some train crew issues. You know, you'll find places where the schedule just isn't optimal for whatever reason. Throw a freight train in there at an inopportune moment. Some weather stuff. You know, you're bound to get it, aren't you? BBC, if you're listening, I think we've got a concept there. That
absolutely.
I would certainly watch that.
You'd certainly host it.
I would watch it.
You're pitching for this, aren't you? Yeah, I'd be the geek that you pull out every now and then that just says, and the reason this is going wrong is because, and then you put me back in the cupboard.
No, but I see what you mean. It's like, you know, do people realise all the little things? We hear so much about the big things. The other thing I wish people would talk about more is, I know I've been a bit negative about performance at the minute. It's because of what I'm working on in my day job at the minute. I'm thinking about performance a lot. Is that we don't talk about the 80% or more of the time that things actually do work.
Yes.
And I know 80% isn't enough. It should be higher. But and in some cases it is higher. In some operators, it starts with a 9. But, you know, these are high percentages of where day in, day out, hour in, hour out, these people out running our railway are delivering what they're meant to. On time. The fact that it doesn't quite go right some of the time is what we focus on. And I know we should, because we're trying to improve, but it's a wonder it works as well as it does, frankly, in some places, because the infrastructure is old and creaking. There is a lot of human intervention. I was talking to somebody about this in a different context, about safety the other day, and saying, fortunately, we hurt people very infrequently on the railway. It's extremely safe for worker safety and for passenger safety. But actually, if you looked at it as a numbers game, it's a wonder we don't do it more, because there's so much human interaction going on. You know, we have systems and technology, but actually there's a lot of stuff that's just done by people. And any safety professional will tell you that that is how accidents happen, is usually the people, not the systems. And I think that's true of performance too, given how many people it takes to just make this thing run every day. It's a wonder we do get it right 80% of the time.
Well, there's two ways of looking at that as well, because I used to write a monthly thing about performance statistics in a newsletter that no longer exists. And you'd get all these things in and you'd talk to the companies, what were the big things they hit? And there'd be some really unexpected things that nobody could plan for.
The cow on the line.
The cow on the line, the goat on the line. I was on the brand new train years and years ago going to North Wales. They were showing us off. Brand new train with loads of dignitaries on board got delayed going over Anglesey. And it was goats on the line.
Yep.
The thing was, they were furious because they hadn't got goats on the line as one of the things they could put upon display. And they said, we've got loads of animals, but we never thought of goats. And that was they said, oh, fine, we could put cows or sheep or...
And yet goats are such mischievous creatures. You would have thought somebody would have thought of that.
Perhaps they didn't know the Welsh for goat, and so they'd left it for a while.
What is the Welsh for goat?
Right, write to us. Yeah. In the next episode, we'll reveal the Welsh for goat. But it is the little things that stack up. Yes, when they introduced the 12-coach trains in London on Thames Link, when they'd finished all the work, people kept standing, the passengers kept standing where the 8-coach trains stopped and ignoring the 2 coaches each end that were further away. And the crowd modelling people were called in to try and help find solutions to say to people, you can go further. And loads of people said, yeah, but I've stood here for the last 20 years. I've always stood here and got in the front coach of the train. And they said, yeah, but the front coach of the train is now 40 metres further down there. Ah, but I've always stood here.
But, you know, new trains aside, that is actually one of the things that I would have a performance fund pot for nationally, is canopies on stations. Because the amount of trains that don't get dispatched on time because of the weather in this country, we get a lot of rain, especially in the north of England. Where do people want to stand? Wherever the canopy is. Because, funnily enough, humans don't like getting rained on. And, you know, so they'll stand where the canopy is. And they're simply... they're not long enough, because they were built either to fit a shorter train, maybe, back in the day, or maybe whoever was building it just didn't have enough money to build any more canopies at the time that they built them. So there aren't enough. The canopies don't match the trains. I think you could do a lot for punctuality if you just had a canopy investment fund and went out and put up a load of brollies, maybe. Maybe not brollies, because they're not very safe, are they, near an overhead line, for instance. But yeah, canopies, bus stop canopies. They're not that expensive, surely.
Wow.
There you go, you heard it here first.
So far in this podcast that we're rapidly coming to the end of, you've already pitched yourself to be the presenter of A Day in the Life of the Train on the telly. You're now pitching to be the National Canopy Czar. Is there anything else you want to put your name forward for?
Give us another half hour, we'll come up with something else.
While I remember, and I was going to do this at the beginning, I've forgotten completely, but I'll do it now. I just want to play you a little chat I had on the train the other day. I went out for a day with a load of people to say goodbye to the old trains in Liverpool. 46 years. Just imagine buying a car and saying, well, it will still be doing its job exactly the same in 46 years' time. So 46 years old, and they were retiring their old trains, nearly. I think there's one chugging around today.
I saw a photograph of one that's still lingering.
Yes, there's a few left. But they sold out the tickets in hours for this farewell train, and it was organised by the Branch Line Society, raised £13,500 or more for four local charities. But I had a little chat with Kev Adlam, who's the head guy, really, the top guy at the Branch Line Society.
And he is a top guy.
He's a top guy anyway.
I've got very fond memories of years ago having the pleasure of my team organising a Branch Line Society train or two. And they do fantastic work and they are the most lovely people. And I don't think I've ever met such enthusiastic... I've met some very enthusiastic railway people in my life, but these are kind of super next level league of enthusiast, and they've done so well to raise so much money. It's fantastic.
So here's the chat I had with him on that train towards the end of quite a weary day. So we're on a 46-year-old train which is absolutely rammed, six coaches full of enthusiasts saying goodbye to these trains. Why do you and the Branch Line Society get involved in doing this?
I think there's two things, Tony, that really matter to us. The first one is that we love raising funds for good causes, and Merseyrail have selected four amazing charities. So we're going to be donated somewhere in the region of £13,000 for the good causes, so that's our first. The second one is we are so passionate about railways and all the benefits of travel. Why would we not want to be part of this wonderful experience today?
And there's a lot of railway people involved in this today, and a lot of them giving their time and things like that. It's a side of the railway that people don't often know about, that people are happy to give their time for charitable causes and for events like this, as well as to say goodbye to things.
I think one of the other advantages for me is that the railway can often be regarded as fragmented. Events like we're running here on Merseyside today bring the railway community together, and even the volunteers work for a number of different railway organisations, and here they are all collaborating together to raise funds for amazing good causes.
And you got a little award last year, you or the Branch Line Society, from Modern Railways for your work in running all these charity events. Just remind me, because people see these trains going past them on the station and they go, what on earth are all those people doing? And okay, they're having a good day out and whatever. Just remind me how much you've raised over the years since you've been doing that. What was the figure that we came to in the end that you've raised for various charities?
So the total funds raised is £1.25 million, which is an amazing sum of money. And you know what? We've enjoyed every single minute raising it.
When you think that they've raised well over £1 million for charities by people just sitting on a train having a day out. So, you know, if you're out there and you see one of these enthusiast trains, the charters or whatever, going past, and these people stuck inside you, what are they doing? Well, they might be enjoying going out for a day on the train, but also the money that they're happy to pay that they know goes to some really key charities and that makes a difference for people. Just remember that. So don't feel too sad for them that they've been stuck. You know, I travelled around Merseyrail so often in the last couple of years, I can back of my hand. But the money that's been raised is fantastic and it's great.
Yeah, and it is the only time that I've ever seen people be kind of, I won't say happy with the delay, but yeah, actually sometimes happy with the delay, because what inevitably happens, because these aren't passenger services, they're, you know, special trains, they get, you know, put in a freight loop or get held somewhere. And if that happened to you as a passenger, you'd be furious, wouldn't you? Why is my train not going anywhere? Whereas these people are sat there going, oh, I haven't been in this loop before. This is excellent, you know, and kind of watching the world go by. So it's an interesting, if you ever get the chance, it's a really interesting day out.
They are an unusual group of people as well, because if you go onto a bit of railway, you have to do all of it. So if you go into a siding, they asked to know how close to the buffers the train got, and that it was on the radios. Yes,
yeah.
we are 3 metres away, 12 feet.
Because they're not all into that, but apparently some of them are really into that. And
they have to walk to
knowing precisely how close and wanting to be as close as possible to, have said that they've been on that line. It's a whole art. Art, science? I don't know.
It's a thing.
It's a thing anyway. Yeah, it's a thing.
It's a charity thing generally, and it makes a difference to a lot of people. So if they want to have that fun, and a lot of people give their time to do it, the crews and the support staff give their time free
to do
these things as well. So it may look a bit weird to you if you don't understand it, but to the people involved, they have a great day out.
And are the charities linked to where the special is operating? So in this case, were they for Merseyside charities?
Hear me rummaging in my bag.
Oh,
here we are.
That was not a sound effect. That was genuine rummaging.
Well, the one I was on, they raised money for Centre 56, a domestic abuse charity, Rescue Me, an animal sanctuary, Blackburn House, a charity supporting development of local and vulnerable women, and Parkinson's charity as well. on that one.
So fabulous. They got, quite broad yeah. coverage they, there. They tried to make sure topics. That different. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And the previous one, I think, had been involved with the hospice and some other things. So it's lovely. Great. So thank you to those people that give up their time to do these really weird charter trips and days out and stuff, because people have a bit of fun. Yeah. They colour in their bits of track that are rare, and they raise really some great money for
some decent charity. Money. Long may it continue, Kev, and hopefully you've got somebody to hand the baton on to eventually when you hang up your Branch Line Society boots, but not yet, please. No, more to do.
The thing is, as they're getting into the last hour of each trip, you can already hear them talking. I'm thinking about doing one too, and they're already on the next one. Yeah. I spoke to him about two other ones that probably need to be organised in the last year. He said, oh, already on to them. Yeah, I'm already talking to them. Don't worry. You know,
good stuff. So,
right, we're running rapidly out of time.
Yes, and we probably need to talk about the next one of these then, don't we, Tony? So I think we're probably going to be into Christmas season soon, aren't we? So no doubt another brief hiatus, and then we might get back to some special guests, mightn't we, next?
We might indeed. We need to broaden out the scope of things we talk about as well, so still welcome ideas.
And I think we're going to try and get, maybe in the new year, get our hands on some people who might have retired or be retiring from their yes. service in the railway, because people are always a bit more giving, aren't they, when they're not on the payroll anymore. So we're hoping for some gossip and some insight. Genuinely, I think people, not just gossip, I think when people have hung their boots up, they do feel like they can talk a little bit more freely about things and, you know, reflect on a career well spent, hopefully, in the industry. So we'll do a bit of that. And I'm going to revisit the Parallel Lines inbox to look for some of the suggestions that people have given us. So if you do have any more for us, if you'd like to email us, please do at contact@pwlines.com.
And specifically as well, if you've got an opinion on blowing whistles on stations,
oh, yeah.
we'd love to hear that. You can send us a written comment or a voice note. You can send it to one of us directly if you've got our contact numbers as well. We'd love to hear your 30-second defence of it. And if you know what Welsh for goat is as well, we're quite
yeah,
happy to
I really
that.
Want to hear what Welsh for goat is, and more on whistles and other things to do with punctuality. I think we focused on that a lot in this episode, so your thoughts welcomed on that. Thanks, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
That's been a good gossip, hasn't it? Now, you've got to give me a lift back to the station now. That you get all the fun, but it's been great, and have a fantastic Christmas.
Ready for a white knuckle ride to the station.
I thought you were going to say ready for a white Christmas.
Oh, that too.
We'll see you soon.